You're listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the phone is Michael Collins Piper, whose latest book, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, a panoramic overview of the historical, religious, and economic origins of the New World Order, is a must-read. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Pleased to be with you today, Dave.
Mike, I want to ask you, why did you write this book?
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's a book that I really never thought I would write. I've written, I don't know, six or seven books, and I'm working on two or three other books. But this book had some interesting origins. I had a previous book that I had written, which was entitled The New Jerusalem, Zionist Power in America.
Right.
And that book was essentially, there was some editorial comment by me, but it was largely an assembly of facts and figures, data and other information taken from pro-Israel and Jewish sources, which demonstrated beyond any question that there is an extraordinary amount of wealth and power in the hands of the American Jewish community, and that they have used this primarily, but not exclusively, to advance the cause of the State of Israel.
Right.
And, you know, after I wrote that particular book, there were many, many people who said to me, my God, I knew there was this extraordinary influence in America, but I didn't know how extraordinary it was until I read your book. And, of course, that book was entitled The New Jerusalem. The title was founded on the premise that, in fact, the United States today has become the New Jerusalem. Well, at that time, it occurred to me, and I actually said something in the book, in the introductory pages to that book. I said, well, maybe in many respects, America is not the New Jerusalem. Maybe it's the New Babylon. And I left it hanging there because I knew that the concept of the New Babylon was something that had long grabbed the interest and the attention of many, many people. You know, many people have suggested that the Antichrist will arise out of the New Babylon and so forth. So I was kind of like toying with the readers. But on the other hand, in the back of my mind, I was laying the groundwork, whether knowingly or not, for this book, The New Babylon. Now, I will say this much, that most of what appeared in the New Jerusalem has been incorporated into this new book, The New Babylon. But aside from the original material, I have added several hundred pages of historical documentation, historical references, bringing the whole picture together. This book has a long title, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, a panoramic overview of the historical, religious, and economic origins of the New World Order. And yet there is another subtitle, and that's Inside the Rothschild Empire, the Modern-Day Pharisees. Now, that is a mouthful, but it's an important mouthful because
right.
This is what I have explored in the New Babylon. And the reason why I took on this approach, because this subject of the New World Order has been something that has been rattling around in what people call the Patriot Movement, the Nationalist Movement, you know, have different names for it, but it's been rattling around in the independent alternative media for a long, long time. And now since the rise of the Internet, which I have problems with because there's so much disinformation and misinformation out there circulating on the Internet, this term, the New World Order, has become quite popularized, at least among those who care about the issue. You'll recall that George H.W. Bush used the term the New World Order in a speech back during his presidency, which caused quite a stir because, you know, although the patriots and the nationalists had talked about this concept of a New World Order, it had never been firmly or fully verbalized or enunciated by any major public officials in any public address. There had been intimations about it in probably hundreds, if not thousands, of written works coming out of the big powerful think tanks, groups such as the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group. This concept of a New World Order, as most people understood it, was the idea that there would ultimately be some sort of world government. Some people have called it a one-world socialist government. Some have called it a one-world police state. The essential idea, as it was enunciated in these mainstream establishment-type publications, would be that ultimately we could bring war to an end, we could establish a situation where there was great cooperation between all the nations of the globe, that everyone would be brought to a similar level. You know, these are idealistic ideas. The basic thought of it is not so bad, but when you start looking at the reality of how these groups and power brokers on the globe global stage wanted to bring about such a quote-unquote New World Order, it always appeared to be that you would lose nationalism. Nations of the world would essentially lose their borders. They would lose their national integrity. The various parliaments and congresses would cede their power to an international organization. Now, for many, many years, people were worried, and rightly so, that the United Nations would be the vehicle for the New World Order. However, I believe, and I think I have documented, not only in this book, The New Babylon, but in other writings that I have done, writings and books, that for all intents and purposes, the United Nations has essentially been sidelined. It's no longer considered the primary framework around which a New World Order can be achieved.
Right.
And I believe, and this is what the foundation of this book, The New Babylon, is, I believe that unfortunately, I say that unfortunately as an American, unfortunately my nation, my tax dollars, the blood and treasure of this country, the young men and women in our armed forces, our national treasury, are being used as the vehicle to establish a New World Order. So there is this recognition of this phenomenon, and many, many people have written about the New World Order.
Mm-hmm.
Been a lot of good writing out there, and I'm talking about critics of the New World Order who have written a lot of important things, and there have been endless videos and internet podcasts. I mean, it goes on and on and on. In addition, and this is important to introduce this here, there have been many who have written about the Rothschild Empire, the international financial dynasty, now largely centered in London, but which stemmed originally from Frankfurt, Germany. A gentleman by the name of Meyer Rothschild had five sons. He was an early banker, moneylender,
right.
Jewish man living in Frankfurt who established a substantial fortune. And then from that fortune, he sent his five sons off to the various capitals of Europe to further the Rothschild dynasty. Now, as I said, many, many people who write about the New World Order correctly divine the fact that the New World Order is largely framed around the international financial networks, the big international capitalist entities. And, of course, the biggest of them all has always been, this global financial framework has been established, has always been the Rothschild family.
And when was the global financial framework established?
Well, the Rothschild family, Meyer Rothschild, was active primarily in the latter half of the 18th century, that is in the late 1700s.
Mm-hmm.
But he died sometime in the late 1700s. His five sons, however, they were sent off to Paris. One remained in Frankfurt, one went to London, one went to Paris, another went to Naples, and I'm missing somebody somewhere, I believe. But in any case, the sons were spread throughout Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened was, during that time frame, the Rothschilds essentially emerged in the early part of the 19th century as the primary and by far the wealthiest international banking house.
And that's a fact.
And that is just an absolute fact. Any even mainstream historical writings will affirm this. A lot of people have suggested it was at the time of the fall of Napoleon, his defeat at Waterloo, that set the stage for the absolute rise of the Rothschild dynasty. Now, what is interesting, or I should say, what is important to point out in the context of what I've written about in the New Babylon, and it's not fashionable to talk about this.
Right.
But the fact is that there had been, during the two to three hundred years preceding the rise of the House of Rothschild, there had been a rise of international finance as it consolidated. You know, it wasn't just your local banker anymore. We had these international financial operations. Many of them tended to be centered in London, but they were all throughout Europe, and they were largely in the hands of closely interconnected Jewish families. And the Rothschilds were really just one among them. However, as I say, in the first several decades of the 19th century, the Rothschilds rose to reign supreme. The other Jewish financial houses often ended up intermarrying with the Rothschilds or cooperating with them. There were rivalries between all of them, but the Rothschilds are the ones who basically became they've been called the kings of kings.
Right.
The amount of money that they accumulated, I mean, the figures are staggering. The Rothschilds, and by all accounts, the Rothschilds were what we would today call multi-billionaires back as early as like the 1830s and 1840s. And they have not gotten any poorer.
No.
They have not gotten any poorer. And you know, in the book, I've cited some figures, some flat-out figures, but the figures are so staggering. The figures are staggering today when you look at them.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you consider the rate of inflation, when these people were already billionaires back in the 1830s, think of what they are essentially worth today. And what we have to understand here is that the Rothschild family, because of their staggering wealth, they have financial interests all over the globe, not just in traditional international banking, but they have bought control of so many interests, you know, mining interests,
right,
oil interests. Everybody identifies the name Rockefeller with oil, but the Rockefellers are latecomers, Johnny-come-latelys, compared to the Rothschild family. And what we also have to keep in mind is that with the Rothschilds having such immense wealth and industrial power at their hands, we can't forget that, as I say. What they have done, they have been in this luxurious position of being able to seed other fortunes. And these people have remained in the Rothschild sphere of influence. And what has happened as a consequence of this, this international construct, this international framework connected to the Rothschild Empire, has all become part and parcel of the framework for what we know of as a New World Order. Now, I want to digress for a moment and give you an example of how the Rothschilds and the people I call their satellites have seeded other powerful fortunes and made billionaires out of people who were never known. Perfect example. The Rothschild family, in many respects, provided a lot of tactical and financial support to the rise of the Bronfman family. Edgar Bronfman, for many years, was head of the World Jewish Congress. Before that, his father, Sam Bronfman, was head of the World Jewish Congress, and they made their money basically in organized crime, in bootlegging, prostitution, gambling. They were the semi-legitimate side of what we would call the Meyer-Lansky crime syndicate.
Right.
Well, the Bronfmans themselves became billionaires in their own right, and they too have been responsible for seeding other fortunes. For example, the Bronfman family helped bring about the rise to influence of a Boston construction and real estate developer named Mortimer Zuckerman. Now, Mortimer Zuckerman, 25 years ago, was basically, maybe a little longer ago than that, time is flying here, but Mortimer Zuckerman was essentially a lower-level business partner of the Bronfman family in a number of Bronfman family enterprises. And now, today, Mortimer Zuckerman is one of the wealthiest men in America, as a consequence of that, one of the wealthiest men in the world, a billionaire in his own right.
Right.
He utilized his billions to buy control of U.S. News and World Report and make it a forum for his strongly pro-Israel point of view. He also bought control of the New York Daily News, and he also, for a time, owned the Atlantic Magazine. So he emerged as a very powerful figure in his own right, to the point that for several years he was president of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. That's the name of this entity, and that's a very powerful position indeed.
Right.
Now, again, there is yet another level here of Mr. Zuckerman, who is a protege of the Bronfmans, who were proteges of the Rothschilds. Mr. Zuckerman took a young man under his wing, a young man that no one had ever heard of, whose name was Daniel Snyder. Well, today, Daniel Snyder is a billionaire. He is the owner of the Washington Redskins football team. And I'm here to tell you how Daniel Snyder achieved his billions.
Okay.
And this is a little known story, but it's very relevant, particularly in this time when the subject of immigration and the problems stemming from illegal and legal immigration are plaguing America and very much a topic of popular discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel Snyder, for all intents and purposes, is the one individual who, through his enterprises, assembled the largest primary database of Hispanic and Spanish surnamed Americans through what they call boiler room operations all over the country.
Right.
Daniel Snyder assembled the names of people in various communities as a Spanish surnamed people, both legal and illegal immigrants, sold them long-distance telephone calling cards, cheap mortgages on houses, and we're seeing the consequence of that. The Latin American immigrants in the United States today are being devastated because a lot of them were taken in by these things.
Right.
They got easy car loans. They got credit cards. And, of course, the assembly of all these mailing lists of credit cards and bank loans and mortgages and this is and that's, you know, is a very lucrative business.
Sure.
And Daniel Snyder is the guy who set the whole framework up. And he made billions as a consequence, obviously, steered tens of billions of dollars more to many, many other corporations that were benefiting from the framework that Daniel Snyder established. So you see, here's Daniel Snyder, who's probably not more than about 55 years old, who directly or indirectly obviously, is a satellite of the Rothschild Empire. They have so much money in their hands that they are able to put up money for other people who then produce billions more for many, many other entities in this tight circle.
That's their modus operandi.
Yes, and this is exactly what it has come down to, and they are all very closely connected. If they all don't know Baron Rothschild in London directly, they know someone who does know him.
Right.
And it is important, although a lot of people don't like to discuss it, it's always been politically incorrect to talk about people's religions until quite recently it became popular to talk about the Muslims and their religion, but
right.
The Rothschilds are Jewish, and most of the people who have benefited directly from their largesse are Jewish, who are strong supporters of Israel, and then peripherally, people who will work for them and work for their cause will also benefit, and that of course includes American members of Congress who receive money in campaign contributions from the well-heeled American Jewish community. And of course, one thing which we cannot forget about in this bigger context here is that all of the major networks, all of the major television and radio broadcast networks are owned outright by families and financial groups, which are all in the Rothschild sphere of influence.
That's a fact.
It's just an absolute fact. People say it's a conspiracy theory to say that the Jews dominate the media. No, I'm sorry. It's a fact. The Jews do dominate the media.
In fact, they brag about it.
And they do. That's the amazing thing about it. You don't need to refer to neo-Nazi publications or Ku Klux Klan publications to hear the claim that the Jews control the media. You can refer to Jewish newspapers and Jewish publications. And in fact, in the New Babylon, I cite Jewish sources which actually proclaim Jewish domination of the American media. I'll tell you, here's another example of this.
Okay.
And I know this really concerns a lot of people because they get very uneasy when you talk about this. But, you know, Vanity Fair magazine was one of the old line, what they old called the WASP establishment magazines. Well, it was taken over by the Newhouse family. They are, at one point, they were said to be the richest Jewish family in America. S.I. Newhouse and Donald Newhouse, they're certainly worth, I think, about $8 billion apiece. Last figure I recall cited from, I think it was from the Forbes 400. The Forbes, of course, being certainly a mainstream publication. But in any case, the Newhouse family owns Vanity Fair magazine. And every year, Vanity Fair does a piece called The New Establishment.
Right.
And they cite the 100 most powerful people in America, and these are usually people in the media. Well, a few years ago, they had the list of the 100 most powerful people, and I forget the exact figures, but there were something like 57% of those listed who were Jewish. And of the remaining people on the list, most of those people were key figures in the mass media. Now, what's interesting is that of the other people listed who were not Jewish, most of these people were people in the fashion industry or in the art world or in the movie industry, including actors and actresses, whose entire fortune, whose entire celebrity is directly related to the fact that they have been the employees of the other 62% on the list.
Right.
So in other words,
so it's 100%.
So I mean, and now they include a couple actors and actresses, on the list.
That.
You know what I mean? And you know, these actors and actresses, you know, however talented they may be, however much we love to see them on screen, you know, Tom Cruise. Well, I mean, they would be nothing if it weren't for the fact of the sponsorship that they've received in the mass media in this country. Now, I've only been talking here about the broadcast media. What about the major newspapers in this country?
What about them?
Washington Post, New York Times, Los Angeles Times, Chicago Tribune, the New Orleans Times-Picayune. These are all in the hands of Jewish families. Then we come to the major news magazines, Time, Newsweek, and as I mentioned before, U.S. News and World Report. It's kind of interesting. Now, the family in Washington, D.C., the Meyer-Graham family, they were the longtime owners of the Washington Post. Now, this is very, very instructive, too, in the context of our discussion here of this interconnected families and financial networks in the Rothschild sphere of influence that, as I say, constitutes our new Babylon, those who reign supreme.
Right.
The Washington Post was purchased in the 1930s, I believe. I forget the exact year, by a guy by the name of Eugene Meyer. Now, Eugene Meyer was essentially a war profiteer from World War I, a Jewish man, a war profiteer, who was a cousin of the Levi Strauss family of San Francisco, And they are among the richest Jewish families in the world. He's one of their cousins, okay? He was also related to the Grand Rabbi of France, okay? Well, he later became president of the World Bank, and he was one of the first members of the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. So he buys the Washington Post, and his daughter, Catherine Meyer, later married a gentleman by the name of Graham, she has since died, but the fact is they owned the Washington Post, and then they purchased Newsweek magazine.
Right.
But here's what a lot of people don't realize is that although they're popularly known as the owners of the Washington Post, they own a substantial interest in it. You know, they say that 3% of a major corporation can be a controlling interest. Well, the Graham family owned, I think, as much as possibly 20% of the Washington Post. But what a lot of people don't realize is that those 80% remaining holdings in the Washington Post were controlled by other major banks, financial institutions, financial groups that, again, can be connected directly to the Rothschild sphere of influence. So while the Grahams were the celebrity owners of the Washington Post, they were actually, in the end, a minority stockholder. But they were the public face of the Washington Post. Well, now the Washington Post Newsweek empire is faltering, and they just sold Newsweek for a dollar to a wealthy Jewish billionaire, obviously wealthy, a Jewish billionaire named Sidney Harman, and he bought it for a dollar, and of course he says that he bought Newsweek to help keep alive a wonderful publication.
Oh yeah, terrific.
Well, you know, here we go again. It's like a family deal. It's all part of the same tightly knit group, and it should be noted for the record that Sidney Harman's wife is Jane Harman, a congresswoman from California. And it is no coincidence that a few years ago, the National Security Agency was wiretapping the home phone of someone operating on American soil who was known to be an agent of the Israeli government. And they overheard this agent of the Israeli government cutting a deal with Mrs. Harman, who is now the owner of Newsweek and a member of Congress. She was agreeing to use her influence to help block a criminal inquiry into the activities of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, the very powerful lobby here in Washington. Now, she was never prosecuted for this. They were promising to guarantee, use pressure to get her a post as chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Now, here is a foreign government, a foreign agent representing a foreign government, promising to use his influence on behalf of this woman, who in turn was promising to use her influence on behalf of other agents of that foreign government. I mean, we're talking espionage, we're talking treason, we're talking obstruction of justice.
Why aren't they registered with the Foreign Agents Registration?
Yeah, I mean, it is just extraordinary. And now this woman who in some places would be strapped into a chair and made to breathe poison gas as a traitor, or walked up a scaffold and hanged by the neck until dead, or blindfolded and shot by a firing squad.
Right.
This woman is now the owner of Newsweek magazine.
That seems fair. Mike, let me just tell our listeners, because you really have tied it all together in this book, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, and I'm sure that there's a lot of folks listening right now who want to get their hands on a copy of it. Well, there's a couple ways to do that. If you have access to the internet, you can go to AmericanFreePress.net. That's AmericanFreePress.net, all lowercase, no spaces. And right at the top there, you click the bookstore tab. And when you click the bookstore tab, you'll actually see Mike's book, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, right in front of you. You can buy it right there. Or alternatively, if you don't have access to the internet, you can call 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-NEWS, which translates into 6397. 888-699-6397 to get your copy of The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, which I called really a guidebook for unraveling the mysteries of the New World Order. Mike, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You know, another point I wanted to make in relation to this aspect of media control.
Yes.
You know, a lot of people dismiss the tabloids in the supermarkets and say, oh, well, they're crazy. They're full of stories about aliens and three-headed babies and so forth. But over the past several years, the tabloids have broken some major political stories, including, for example, the story of Senator John Edwards and his mistress and their illegitimate child. You know, this is a story which has pretty much put an end to any future political ambitions of John Edwards. And this is a man who almost became vice president of the United States, at the very least. But one thing which you have to keep in mind about these tabloids is that, for example, the old National Enquirer, which is still being published.
Right.
The National Enquirer was known for years to have longstanding connections, not only to organized crime, but to the CIA. And when you consider the fact, and which has been documented, that the CIA itself often interacted directly with organized crime in political ventures, in money laundering, all sorts of intrigues that have been written about by eminently mainstream writers, you come to understand that the National Enquirer has always had a peculiar place of its own in the American pantheon of journalism.
Right.
You know, they've often, the National Enquirer was known for years at times to have floated stories into the media on behalf of secret powers behind the scenes. Well, there were several other tabloids at work. For example, there was the Sun and the Star, and I'm not even sure the names of them all.
Right.
Last count, I believe there were five of these tabloids that you find regularly in the newsstands. Now, they all have different names, and, you know, they all have different stories about different actors and actresses. And actually, in recent years, the tabloids have been in the forefront of putting out some of these stories about Barack Obama having been born in a foreign country and all sorts of other stories surrounding Mr. Obama. But what most people don't realize is that all of these tabloids, despite their different names and despite the different publishing entities connected to them, they are all owned by one very shadowy holding company called Evercore Partners. Now, Evercore Partners, you know, no one knows who really are the investors in Evercore Partners. But what we do know is that it is primarily, again, it's largely representative of major Jewish families and financial interests who pulled their money together for a variety of international ventures. And one of them just happens to have been buying control of all the tabloids. Well, the guy who heads Evercore Partners is a guy by the name of Roger Altman, A-L-T-M-A-N. He's a member of the very powerful Council on Foreign Relations, which a lot of people call a New World entity and New World Order entity, and I'll talk about that in a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Roger Altman did serve as an Assistant Secretary of the Treasury in the Clinton administration, and now, as I say, he is the head of this Evercore Partners, which essentially controls the tabloids. And I'm sorry to tell you that most of what many Americans know about anything comes from those tabloids.
Unfortunately.
People would say, well, that just doesn't make sense. You know, it does make sense that this massive control over the media has to extend at all levels.
Right.
Whether it's the nice mainstream newspapers or magazines, but also down to the very lowest common denominator.
Right, which happens to be what most Americans digest.
Exactly. Now, I mentioned the Council on Foreign Relations.
Mm-hmm.
This is important here, particularly in this context, because we know that the Council on Foreign Relations has been an important and powerful entity.
Right.
It's been operating in New York since roughly about 1919 and 1920.
I've been actually to the Council on Foreign Relations on
several occasions.
Yeah, I think
it's the Pratt House.
That's right.
In this context of discussing the New World Order, we have often heard over the years about the Council on Foreign Relations. Of course, it was established, as I mentioned, in New York in 1921, roughly, 1919, right after World War I.
Right.
And the whole thesis of the Council on Foreign Relations was that important people would get together and work to conduct a correct foreign policy for the United States. Now, the people who were inducted into the Council on Foreign Relations were distinguished lawyers, financiers, quote-unquote, people of substance, people out of the Harvard, Yale, Princeton world, very elite circles. And over the years, through both Democratic and Republican administrations alike here on American soil, Council on Foreign Relations members predominated certainly in the State Department and in the foreign policy realm, but in other realms as well. Many people have called it the secret government. Many people have said, oh, the Council on Foreign Relations is the New World Order.
Right.
It's a little more complex than that. This is another reason why I felt the need to write about the New World Order, to explain what the New World Order is and what it isn't. Now, people say, ah, the Rockefellers control the Council on Foreign Relations. Well, for years, David Rockefeller primarily was a major figure in the Council on Foreign Relations. He's 96 years old now. I don't see him as a major threat for the future, to be perfectly candid here. But what we have to remember about the Council on Foreign Relations, as distinguished as it is, as powerful as it is, as notorious as it is, for that matter, it has always been essentially no more than a junior cousin to the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. Now, that name, Royal Institute of International Affairs, you might think the Queen of England. No, the Royal Institute of International Affairs is the London equivalent, but as I say, the senior cousin of the Council on Foreign Relations, and the Royal Institute of International Affairs has always been under the domination of the Rothschild family and the international banking elite centered in the city of London. And the United States, former colony of Britain, in some respects remains a colony of Britain, if you want to look at it in that context. But this, again, this idea of the Council on Foreign Relations being the ultimate seat of the New World Order is far from the truth. That brings in groups like the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group. The Trilateral Commission was, in fact, established by David Rockefeller, and it has always been an internationalist group, you know, with these kind of New World Order designs. And certainly the Bilderberg Group, which goes back to 1954, it has been a project of the Rothschild family and their European consorts.
Right.
So again, what we have here are all these international organizations that are in one form or another advocating programs that will lead to the establishment of a world government. These projects such as NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement,
right.
And then there was
CAFTA.
CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. Then there was a similar free trade agreement for South America.
Of course, GATT.
Yeah, all of these international constructs have all operated in the sphere of these international financial houses in the Rothschild network.
And that's doing away with the identity of nations, right?
Exactly. Even NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, overrode national sovereignty and made alliances. I mean, and this goes back to something during World War II. There was a movement which received some widespread interest, mainly because it was promoted by the mass media. It was called Union Now. A guy by the name of Clarence Streight, which is spelled Streit, wrote a book called Union Now. And in that book, he frankly talked about the reunification of the United States with the British Empire.
Right.
Well, now that's not a coincidence that he would be promoting this, because that was a concept that Cecil Rhodes promoted.
Rhodes Scholar, right?
Through the Rhodes Scholarships, exactly.
Right.
The idea that the United States and Britain should be reunited. Well, it's not a coincidence, it is not an accident, that as wealthy and as powerful and as influential as Cecil Rhodes was, Cecil Rhodes was in fact sponsored by, guess who? The Rothschilds.
Now, Mike, I want to ask you this. I want to ask you a question that's very important, because some folks would think, so we have a one world government, we break down all the national identities. What do the Rothschilds care about that? Does that go back to their international banking roots?
It goes, well, you know, that's, you just put your finger on the key to it all. And this is where we enter a realm that just terrifies the hell out of people.
Mike, the only reason I put my finger on it is because I read your book. I'll tell you that right now.
Well, you know, I've been kind of dancing around this, just trying to lay the framework for what a lot of our listeners are familiar with, but for what other people may not be familiar with. But you see, this is what it all comes down to.
Okay.
The Rothschild family have long had an agenda, and I think that agenda can best be summarized by a quote which appears in The New Babylon from one of the early biographers of Meyer Rothschild, the founder of the dynasty. Mr. Cohen, who was Jewish, wrote a book called The Exemplary Life of the Immortal Banker, Mr. Meyer Amschel Rothschild. So obviously he was somebody who liked Mr. Rothschild.
Yeah.
And what he said about Rothschild was this: Meyer Rothschild was a zealous believer in the Talmud and chose it alone as the guiding principle of all his actions. Now, here's where this discussion of the New World Order gets what many people would say is controversial.
Right.
Because people say you're not supposed to talk about religion, and they say, well, the New World Order is without religion. I beg to differ. Meyer Rothschild was guided in all his actions, according to this biographer, by the Talmud. The Talmud is an ancient set of Jewish religious teachings that came after the Old Testament. And the Talmud, and that is spelled T-A-L-M-U-D, the Talmud, for all intents and purposes, is the guidebook for Jewish religious thinking, Jewish philosophical thinking, all teachings relating to the conduct of Jewish life. And when we consider the fact that the Rothschild family was very, very Jewish, very, very religious, they were guided by this philosophy. This was the foundation for what they were trying to achieve. And when you start looking into the Talmud, here are several things that you find. And very few people have ever actually read. The Talmud is not just one book.
Okay.
The Talmud is literally, I would say, probably thousands of pages that have been assembled. Although there have been over the years other eminent Jewish thinkers, such as Maimonides and Joseph Caro, who have written smaller books that have kind of adopted the foundation of the Talmud. This was written after the life of Jesus. They came out after the New Testament. And one of the things which has been pointed out, and this is a peripheral matter, but I think it should be pointed out, the Talmud, you know, we hear so much about the Quran these days. Everybody knows about the Quran, but nobody knows about the Talmud. Well, the fact is, if you look in the pages of the Quran, you will find reverential discussion of Jesus Christ and his mother Mary. In fact, in downtown Tehran, Iran, you will find a square entitled Mary Square, named after the mother of Jesus. Now, the average American who thinks that the Muslims in Iran are out to massacre all the Christians of the world, they would be absolutely astounded to learn that there is a square commemorating the mother of Jesus Christ. Well, if you look in the Talmud, you will find the most extraordinary attacks on Jesus Christ, upon his mother, upon the Christian people, and upon the Christian religion. I mean, if I went to a public gathering here in Washington and read excerpts from the Talmud, people would hang me because they would think I was a Muslim agitator preaching against Jesus, when in fact I would be quoting the holiest books of the Jewish religion. So a lot of people don't understand that. In this context of the New World Order, what we have to understand is that this idea of a New World Order is found in the Talmud. It's found in these Jewish religious teachings. And as scary as this sounds like something out of a science fiction film or something, but they actually teach in the Talmud, and this was the thing that drove Meyer Rothschild, remember this, that the idea was that the Jews, the Jewish people, now, this is not to suggest that every Jewish person on the face of the planet is out there actively conspiring, but the most powerful Jewish families and financial interests, guided by the Talmud, believe that the Jewish people are superior to all other people.
Right.
We hear this idea of God's chosen people, but if you look in the Jewish religious teachings, you find that they state very clearly that ultimately the riches of the world will come into the hands of the Jewish people, and that the Jewish people will dominate all nations, that all people will look to the Jewish people for leadership, for religion, for the scraps that will be handed down to them. And this is not something that I made up. This is something that can be found. Even the most cursory search of the internet will find spirited debate about the nature of the Talmud. But despite, you know, and there will be these disagreements, and there will be people who will try to say, oh, well, this isn't really what the Talmud means. But ultimately, yes, when you explore the Talmud, you find that this is exactly what it does mean.
I think these are the founding principles of the Rothschilds.
These were the founding principles of the Rothschild Empire. As one reverential Jewish writer put it in a book. He wrote a book called The Jewish Utopia. His name was Michael Higger. He was an academic. And the first copy of the book that was uncovered for public consumption was actually donated to a state library by the Rabbis organization in Texas. So this is a book that represents Jewish religious teachings. And this describes a world, a Jewish utopia, in which, as I've said, all of the other people of the world will be dominated by the Jewish people. You know, I guess we need to put this in context.
Okay.
We fought World War II, so we've been told, to stop a mad supremacist, Adolf Hitler, from dominating the world. We were told that Adolf Hitler preached the supremacy of the German people, the Aryan people, and that they would dominate the planet, that they would control the planet, everybody else would do their bidding.
Mm-hmm.
And we were told that this was a very bad thing, that there's no one group of people who is superior, no one group who is supreme, no one group who should rule the world. And yet, here in the Jewish Talmud, which was the guiding principle of Meyer Rothschild and his international empire, we find that the Jews aren't the chosen people of God. They are the people who will come to dominate the earth, and rightfully so, and that all the riches will be in their hands. This is what it's come down to. And now the United States has become the most powerful nation on the planet. A lot of problems here. The nation probably does face bankruptcy. It's probably much worse than we realize. But I don't think there's anybody who would dispute that the United States certainly has the most powerful military. It has one of the biggest budgets of all. It rules the world.
Right.
And who rules the United States? This is where we come back to this idea of the New Babylon. A very famous Jewish writer, Max Diamond, said that essentially the United States was the New Babylon. And this is what really surprised me, because I had been thinking of that concept. The old story is that the Jews were in exile in Babylon, and they pined for their days of life in Jerusalem. But even though they were essentially said to be in captivity in Babylon, they were already in control of the finances of Babylon. They outlasted Babylon. Babylon is no more, except for here in American soil. But all of this immense wealth and power has been accumulated in the hands of these people who, through the various organizations that they control, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Bilderberg Group, all of these front groups that are promoting this New World Order agenda, they ultimately receive their funding and their promotion from the Rothschild Empire, its satellites, and their network of influence, not only in the United States, but around the globe.
That's why it's so important for our listeners, really, to pick this book up, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme. You can go to the internet if you have access to it. It's AmericanFreePress.net, AmericanFreePress.net, all lowercase, no spaces. And right at the top of the site, you'll see a bookstore tab. Just click that, and you'll go into American Free Press First Amendment Books and Videos, and The New Babylon is right there, prominently placed. If you don't have access to the internet, give us a call at 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-6397. The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, and I called it, Mike, before, a guidebook for unraveling the mysteries of the New World Order. It really is. It has so much information in here, and you really have not left any stone unturned.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. You know, as I say, it's a very complex subject. You can, just as we've been discussing here today, you can go in several different directions. Really, I think I summarize it all in just a few short sentences here at the end, that if you look at all these forces that are, and I'm repeating myself here, but if you look at all the forces that are promoting the breakdown of national governments, that are promoting a worldwide unity, that are at the same time vastly advancing their own financial control, even as the nations and the peoples of the nations are being looted and seeing their standards of living going down, they keep getting richer.
But isn't that how they've always made their money?
Well, this is it. I mean, they have promoted wars. They have promoted national indebtedness. If there was a war between, say, Britain and Germany, there were all these European wars of the 19th century. You could go crazy trying to sort them out. But you would find the Rothschilds or their related satellite banking houses funding both sides of the war.
Right.
And, of course, they would fund the wars by making loans to the various kings. And then these nations would become indebted and saddled with debt. And then, of course, then when the wars were over, there would be the periods of reconstruction and reconciliation. And, of course, more loans would be made available to rebuild. This has been a constant cycle. You find that so much of this money lending and financing of wars and really also of revolutions, I might add, it goes back way, 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 way back. You could take this book, The New Babylon, which is, let's see how many pages.
264.
264 pages, okay. You could take any given chapter in this book and make an entire book out of that chapter.
Right.
Pursuing the various threads. You know, you could have an encyclopedia based upon this,
right,
this book, The New Babylon. And see, that's the thing. It is so complex. And because of this controversial point that what the New World Order really is, the fact that it is largely inspired from the Jewish Talmud makes it a very controversial subject. And I understand that. And a lot of people who want to talk about the New World Order don't want to get into that.
But
and
Mike,
I
understand it's a, right, that. But it's a controversial subject simply because, as you point out very clearly with your meticulous, as I call it, painstaking and exhaustively researched book, you point out that pretty much all of the mainstream media is controlled by one group.
You know, it's kind of interesting because I hear so many people talk about the media. They complain about the media. They don't like the positions of the media. And yet they never want to talk about who owns the media. And I guarantee you that if the major media in this country, the newspapers and the magazines and the broadcast outlets, were purchased by Muslims,
right,
or purchased by Hindus for that matter,
right,
or by Buddhists, Americans would be discomforted by that. They would find great concern in that, and it would be freely discussed, and people would say, well, is it right for one religious group to control the media in this country? And people would uniformly say, well, that's not right.
Sure.
They would say that's not right. I guess to look at it this way, my problem with it is, and I'm talking from a personal standpoint here, my problem with this inordinate Jewish power is that they use this power to advance what is indeed a Jewish agenda, this New World Order, the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, potential wars against Iran. As I always say, I don't see Serbian Americans clamoring for war against Iran, or Japanese Americans, or Indian Americans,
or Italian Americans, or Polish Americans, or Irish Americans.
The list goes on and on.
Right.
But I do see Jewish Americans clamoring for war against Iran.
Right.
And, you know, and I'll be criticized for saying this, but there's not a lot of Jews in the American military. But the American military will ultimately end up fighting this war, and it could turn into a world war.
But that's a fact, Mike, that there aren't a lot of Jews in the military.
Yeah.
That's just a fact.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The only reason that we're sensitized to this is because it's been drummed into our heads from that mainstream media.
This media power.
Mm-hmm.
People don't want to talk about who controls the media. And by avoiding that subject, they implicitly avoid the subject of who is promoting the New World Order, because the New
Right.
World Order is being promoted by the media.
Right, exactly. That's why it's so important. It's so important for you listeners out there to grab this book.
One other point, Dave, we should drive home here, and I've been remiss in not mentioning it.
Okay.
And that is this concept of the Federal Reserve System. A lot of our listeners are familiar with that. Federal Reserve Board of Governors is a presidentially appointed unit of bankers and other financial gurus who ostensibly are the arbiters of our money system. But the actual Federal Reserve System itself is made up of privately owned and controlled banks, all of which, either directly or indirectly, are under the control of, if not the Rothschild family itself, people who are in the Rothschild sphere of influence. And this goes back, this kind of financial influence in the United States goes back really to the, and a lot of people are not aware of that, back to the early 1800s when Andrew Jackson
right.
was fighting the first bank of the United States, which again was an early variation of what we have with the Federal Reserve System in America today that does control our money. And there's nothing federal about the Federal Reserve.
Right.
It's privately owned. It's Rothschild controlled. Rothschild agents on American soil working for banks like Kuhn Loeb, which were part of the Rothschild sphere of influence. They set up the Federal Reserve. Big bankers set up the Federal Reserve. Now, school children are told the Federal Reserve was set up to curtail the influence of the bankers, but it was the bankers who set it up. You cannot understand the predatory nature of the Rothschild dynasty until you consider what the Federal Reserve does here in America. Fortunately, more and more people are becoming aware of it, and there are people who actually dare to say that the Rothschilds have a big influence in it, but they avoid explaining what it is ultimately all about. And as I say, it goes back to the pages of the Talmud.
Right, and of course, the Federal Reserve is part and parcel of the New World Order.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the engine of money, and it's the engine of money in the United States, which is being utilized as the engine of power to militarily advance the New World Order.
Which
you
is
know.
From the Talmud, as you said.
Yes, it's quite circular. It's not really that complex at all. It's just that it's controversial, and some people prefer to avoid hitting it head on.
Here it is, 264 pages. I love the chapters here where you actually name the names.
Yeah, there's multiple chapters in the book where I have gone through. Well, let me just pull that out for a second here, because what I've done, the chapters themselves were, I mean, there are many, many chapters in the book, but one chapter is entitled The Dukes and Duchesses of the Rothschild's American Court.
Right.
And I refer to the 30 most powerful Jewish families. Then there's what I call the lords and ladies of the American Jewish aristocracy, the third tier of the Rothschild's court families. And that is a listing of many, many families and financial groups that are not well known, but are very, very rich and very, very influential in cities around the United States. The other chapter, I have detailed dissections of who some of these people are and some of the things that they own. And one of the things which is evident is that many of these people, though among these, what I've pinpointed in my perspective as the 30 most powerful Jewish families,
right.
they are increasingly taking command of many institutions that have been long associated with the Rockefeller family. So even the Rockefeller family, they owe their early financial success to funding directly and indirectly from the Rothschild sphere of influence. Despite the fame, maybe some would say infamy, of the Rockefeller name, the Rockefellers have never really been as extraordinarily wealthy as many people might perceive.
Mm-hmm.
They've never really had the wide-ranging power that many perceive. So they have always been, you know, really junior cousins, and I don't mean they're related by blood to the Rothschilds, but they've been junior partners of the Rothschilds, if only because of the fact that the Rothschilds themselves had already accumulated billions upon billions of dollars long before John D. Rockefeller was even born. The material is all there in the book for those who care to take a look at the bigger picture. And I think I have provided enough information in the book and citations for anyone who wants to explore the subject further. If they feel that I have fallen down on the job somewhere, or if they feel I haven't told them the whole story, they can go right to the sources themselves.
Is this in its third printing?
It's in the third printing, and we'll probably go to the fourth printing very soon. It's proven quite popular, and I'm glad that it has, because I wanted to get the information out there, taking all of diverse material that's available and putting it together in a way that is logical and historical and chronological, and which pinpoints the real sources of wealth and power and war and bankruptcy.
I don't think it would be alarming to say that this is probably one of the most important books that you would ever put your hands around, because money controls the world. And Mike has laid it out for you historically, and he brought it to the modern day, and he actually names the names. You want to know who's controlling your world? Pick up The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, AmericanFreePress.net. Click on the bookstore tab, or if you don't have access to the internet, 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-6397. Mike, it's a terrific, really terrific book, and I'm certainly not an expert on the New World Order, but I sure do know a lot more than your average person from reading those 264 pages.
Well, I wouldn't call myself an expert either. I've just laid out the material that I've come to know about, and I think people will find it's a consistent thread. I don't think people will find any inconsistencies there at all. Well, I think people need to know it, and I think I've given them a guidebook, and they can do their own research, and if anybody can prove me wrong in anything out there, I'm really waiting to hear from them.
Mike, I just want to make the point that there really isn't another book out there like this, is there?
I don't think so, frankly. There's a lot of books that touch on the New World Order, books that touch on the Rothschilds, but I think this book really ties all of these aspects together. You know, I've not gotten any negative comments about the book. You know, I've written a lot of books. I've had people tell me that this is my best book ever, but I've also had people say that this is the one book that does put it all in perspective and pinpoint what the New World Order really is and why it needs to be derailed.
Absolutely. Michael Collins Piper, author of The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, A Panoramic Overview of the Historical, Religious, and Economic Origins of the New World Order Inside the Rothschild Empire, the Modern-Day Pharisees. Mike, I had a great time. I appreciate the time you took out for this, and I wish you all the luck in this book. And I really do hope a lot of folks pick it up, because the information I got from it really broadened my understanding of this topic.
I've had people tell me it's the best of them all, and I keep thinking, well, damn, I have a few more books to come out. Don't say that yet.
Well, you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to upstage this, but it is a terrific book, and thank you for writing it, because people need this information. Again, The New Babylon, Those Who Reign Supreme, AmericanFreePress.net. That's all one word, lowercase, no spaces, AmericanFreePress.net. Right on the website, you'll see the bookstore tab right at the top. Click on that, and Mike's book is right there. If you don't have the internet, give us a call, 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-6397. Mike, again, thanks so much for taking the time out to talk about your news.
Absolutely, Dave.